It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 638. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for show topics at miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message on Skype. My Skype name is Mike Tech Show, all one word. Follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MikeTechShow, and Facebook, facebook.com/MikeTechShow. Got a great show lined up for you tonight. I'm going to talk about doing a security analysis for clients. And I don't do this a lot, but I'm going to talk about the free tools that I use. Well, actually, some of them are free that I use. And I want to get your input on what you do for an analysis. I have a couple tips on getting a remote service started when you get access denied. I have two tips from last week's show about Microsoft Office tips, one that I had to find for a problem I ran into. And then Lori, my guest from last week, supplied us with a great PDF that I haven't posted up yet, that I'm going to review, and then a stack of email that I'm going to get to. This show is brought to you by Instant House Call. Remotely support your customers unattended and on demand through firewalls. Try it free by clicking on the link on my website at miketechshow.com, or just go to instanthousecall.com and remember to use the promo code MikeTechShow. The show is also brought to you by Malwarebytes Tech Bench Toolset, the all-in-one package of utilities to help you diagnose, repair, and secure Windows PCs. The first thing I want to discuss tonight, doing a security analysis, a security audit, and this is a simple approach to small clients. The first thing I do, and this is an oldie utility that's still around, that still works, and it's the Microsoft Baseline Security Analyzer 2.3. They have a 64-bit and a 32-bit version, and you can run it on the server and have it automatically go to all the workstations and also anything on the network if you're on an Active Directory domain, or you can take it and just run it on each system. The office that I was running this on a couple weeks ago, they have a server, Active Directory. I put it on, ran it on the server, but then I ran it on the option to connect to everything on the network. And one of the problems, I received an error. And this error, if you run into it, I have the solution. The error you get is Windows Update Agent is not supported on this operating system. And the fix for that is to go in to the remote registry services and set it to automatic. And this has to be set from computer management. Then you go on to services and applications, then services, and then the remote registry, and then go into services and make sure that that's set for automatic. Then you're going to be able to just run this from the server. But again, if you run it locally, you're going to get all of the information that you want. I'm going to quickly review some of that. So an example of a scan, you're going to get a report on security updates. And are there any issues with Windows security updates and what could be installed or missing? You're also going to get a review of passwords. And one of the things that was discovered was how many passwords were set to not expire on the server. And then how many accounts or administrators on a computer. Is the firewall on? Is the IIS virtual directory, is it present? Is it locked down? Service accounts, folder permissions, the password policy for SQL accounts. You're going to get a very detailed highlight of a security analysis of the systems that is 21 pages. And then I make that a PDF and I have that on every system. And that's where I begin a security audit. Now, this is information that I will collect, take back, review, and then put a report together and then submit that to my client. So there's a few other pieces that I also run. One, and I've talked about this in the past, a great website, if you want to perform a lookup of any DNS information, this is the perfect site. And you can get lots of great reports. I recommend making sure you have like PDF Creator or any report that you get that you can print to a PDF, because now you got something that you can submit to a client or to someone or to just save for yourself. One of the other tools that I think is required for someone in our business is the full Adobe Acrobat, because I love one feature where if I'm on a web page, and you know how difficult it is sometimes to print a web page, I will make it a PDF by having the extension in the add-in for every browser, and then I can quickly click my Adobe link and say convert web and click convert web page to PDF. Now I get a great PDF of that web page that I can print, I can email to someone. And later on in the show tonight, I'm going to talk about a website that I'm having a problem with that website. So it was easier for me to create a PDF, and I'm going to link the PDF. Once you get a good DNS report, it's actually going to tell you if there's problems with the MX records. Just a great site, and that's viewdns.info. You're going to get lots of great information. Another utility, I like doing a complete inventory and network scan on a network, and I use the Newt Professional Network Inventory. Anybody that was at the Unconvention got a little demo of this from me for the 2017 DC Unconvention. But if you weren't there, and this utility is free for networks with 25 PCs or less. Now, I have the next version because I have a client that has 70 workstations. So I figured if I'm going to run into bigger clients, I want to have a tool that I can do a network inventory of all of the operating systems and give me a nice report of everything that's on that network. Very useful tool. You can also get a little security audit and a nice report to be able to send your client for every workstation and get an HTML file of this that'll give them not just a security assessment, but a software information, hardware information, network information, and that's SIW, System Information for Windows. This is the ultimate tool for getting all of that detail of every single solitary component contained within a computer, whether it be a server, a workstation. This is the first thing that I do when I'm on site for the first time for any client. I make sure I get an SIW inventory of every single system. So with all of this, it's a great start to get a good assessment. Then there's things I do individually where the backups, what are they doing? Do they need encryption? Do they have encryption? So there's a lot of other things of value add that I look at that I can also possibly upsell solutions after my assessment. What I would like from everybody listening, What do you do? What is your process or tools that you can share with us that helps with a security assessment of a small office or even a large office? What do you run? What do you do? I'd be very interested, and I know everybody listening would, so we can put this all together with the tools that I'm mentioning and then add the things that you will also bring to the table. So now, something I ran into, and I've talked about a couple times in the past, but this I ran into last weekend. I have a client that I had to do a deep cleaning on all of their workstations. Instant house call unattended is running on all of the workstations in this office. But one of my problems, I could not remote into a workstation, but this workstation was running. But the instant house call service was not running. So how do you remotely? Should be easy, right? You bring up the services, you remote connect. Not if it's on a regular peer network. If you have a server, an Active Directory, and it's part of the domain, it's a piece of cake. It's the easiest thing in the world to do. But if it's not, you have to do a couple things. This is how to start and stop a service remotely from a workstation that you can log into. So one of the first things I had to do, Annette use the workstation name and then IPC dollar sign and then slash you with the username. So you need to have the local user and then their password. If you follow through these instructions, you can absolutely start a service as long as you have a local admin user of the workstation. So one of the things is after you net use to an IPC dollar sign share, you also net use to the admin dollar sign. Now you're going to be able to connect remotely in the services option. And now once you can remotely see the services, you can go to Instant House Call and you can right-click and start the service. And I was able to do it. As a matter of fact, there's a great command line for just being able to do that and to start it. You can use the SC command and the machine name, the service name to start, and then you need the exact name of the service. Once I did that, I was able to then remote in with Instant House Call and got that started. So wanted to share that tip. I'm pasting another link in the chat that I'm going to have in the show notes. Want to talk about a problem that I ran into that I've been having a long time. I have Word 2010. So I have Office 2010 on my main workstation. And last week I had Lori on talking about all the different Office tips. I wanted to change my default font, and it sounds easy. And if you follow the instructions, you can just go right up, click for the in the fonts, and then set and to make default. It would not change the default. Every time I restart Word, it goes back to the original font, not the font that I'm picking. I found a link that has the answer, and I followed the instructions. Now, the problem, I can't link the web page, because if you go to the web page, there are terrible ads on the web page that will try to go to other websites. And Malwarebytes just goes nuts every time I bring up this web page. So I quickly made a PDF, and I'm going to link the PDF from the show notes, which is an exact image of the WindowsClub.com unable to change default font in Word. Shame on them for having those ads that's trying to redirect and do so many bad things that's coming from the web page. But it's content that I want to share. I have the PDF, and what you have to do if you run into this problem, there's two options, and this is option two, I believe, in the instructions, where you have to go to File, options, then add-ins, then you got to go to the date XML. And then when you go to manage, you got at the bottom, you got to click templates and you got to click go. Now, under the document template, you got to click attach. You now have to navigate to where the normal .dot file is located. You find that file, and mine is at a different location, it seems, than the typical one, and that's why I'm having this problem. Once you do that and click OK, I was able to save my font that I want and all my settings, and it was a piece of cake. It's complicated, but I have the instructions. Next, Lori provided me a couple days ago, and I haven't had a chance to post this up yet. It's a checklist for a new install of Office, things you should consider setting up. So you have an Office setup section. She has a Word section, an Excel, PowerPoint, and Outlook, all with checkboxes for recommended settings and things you should consider when you're setting up Office for the first time for a client. And I think this is great. It's going to be a PDF. I'm going to have it in the tonight's show notes. I'm also going to go back and put it as a link in last week's show. Thank you, Lori, for taking the time to put that together. I really appreciate it. Now, on to emails. And with that, this is a follow-up to last week's show. This is from Curtis. Hi, Mike. I'm not in your business, but I enjoy your show nevertheless. I get a lot of computer questions from friends and through my association with the Twin Cities PC Users Group. I learn a lot from your shows. Thank you. You were discussing Office applications, particularly Word and Outlook, default spacing at the end of paragraphs. Both you and Lori expressed the opinion that no extra space before or after paragraphs should be default. You're both wrong, and here's why. When we write, we put a thought in a scenario and related thoughts and sentences in paragraph. Paragraphs need to be visually separated from each other to help the reader understand what they're reading. In the old days, when we used typewriters, yep, I'm old enough to have learned touch typing in high school. We were taught to either indent the first line of each paragraph or put in an extra line, really old school typewriters like I learned on, or a half line on fancier typewriters that came out in about the 60s to provide this visual separation. Likewise, we learned how to handle text to not have windows or orphans. Those techniques don't work well with computerized word processors for a few reasons. We almost always use proportional fonts now instead of fixed pitch typefaces, common in typewriters, before the IBM Selectric balls. Indenting by using spaces provides imprecise layout. Extra lines, actually extra empty paragraphs, prevent word processor programs, e.g. Word, from properly handling windows and orphans. There is one place where the extra space between paragraphs might be considered a problem. That's when we're entering a multi-line block of information that should not have extra spacing between the lines. That occurs when entering something like an address or a signature block. This problem is easily avoided by using the Shift-Enter key combination to force a new line, not a new paragraph. Also, it's probably a good idea to mark blocks like these with the keep together attitude to avoid splitting across page boundaries. You also discussed fonts that you like or dislike and the problem of using a font that is commonly supported. I'm not aware of any facility in Outlook or any other email client to embed fonts along with messages, but we do have a lot of control in our websites and Word-created documents. In my business of building websites, I like to choose, along with the client, of course, the site's fonts to match the character of the site or business. I'll use more conservative font combinations for a law firm that I might for an artist. I almost always use Google fonts because there are a large number of good, and that's a subjective term, fonts with quite varied characteristics. I usually pick two font families for a website, one for body text and another for headings. It's easy to reference a Google font in a website CSS structure, and virtually all web browsers support web fonts. This gives the website a lot of control over how text is rendered. We can consider the font choices part of the branding of the site. Also, Google fonts are free and allow for unlimited usage. I recommend that a client use the same fonts for their own non-web-based purposes, like documents and printed brochures. Again, this is part of branding the business. All the Google fonts are available for download and can easily be installed on Windows and, I presume, Mac computers. As an example, I use the same fonts for PowerPoint presentations as I use on my website. Please feel free to ask questions. If you choose to use these ideas on your show, it might be best to paraphrase my ideas rather than reading them. Thanks very much and Merry Christmas to you and yours, Kurt. Kurt, I wanted to read this because I wanted the whole context of what you were describing. Your opinion, thank you for sharing it. And what's interesting, I grew up on typewriters and I understand about the spacing. All the clients that I run into, and I'm going to include myself, are annoyed at the default spacing that is put in Word. It's a personal preference type of thing. What color do you like? What type of keyboard? I hate keyboards that click. I love soft, easy, flowing keyboards, but there are many people, Carrie Holzman is one of them, who just loves that click, that old IBM keyboard click. I can't stand it. It's the same when we visually look at something. I agree with you 100% in using the fonts that you use for your website. And you know, I never thought of that. From a branding standpoint, if you have a website with a certain font, wow, all of your correspondences should have that. That's a great idea. And that's why I wanted to read your entire email. There's lots of takeaways here and lots of things to think about. And it's funny that Lori and I were on the same page for that. And that's why even the checklist we're providing, if you don't believe in some of these things, don't do it. Don't implement it. It's subjective what you want to do, but you also have to adapt to your clients. It's like I'm beginning to, I hate my iPhone. I can't stand my iPhone anymore. And I am ready to jump. And you've heard me talk about it and complain about it often enough. But I have so many clients deep-rooted. I got to suck it up and use it because I got to be good at the iPhone because that's where all their problems are. So given all that, that's why we adapt and we take in everything. But Kurt, thank you for sharing your opinions on this. I really appreciate that and encourage anybody. You disagree with something or you want to challenge something, please send it. That's what this is about, to share all of this, you know, and get the different ideas out there. This is from Keith. Windows 7 Peer Server Image Backup. You mentioned in episode 636 about the Windows 7 server, which had the bad hard drive and the bad external USB drive, and you had to rebuild the server and pull the data from a cloud backup. Something you might consider. I'm going to stop here and interject my comment. Shame on me for not doing this because it's so simple. And sometimes it's the simple solutions that we don't see in front of us, and it takes someone else to tell us. Something you might consider is adding a size-appropriate SSD to one of the other workstations in the office and sync the Shadow Protect backup across the network to that machine. Or just run the backup and save directly across the network. Since you have the data offsite, that That covers the absolute catastrophic event. Having an image on another machine should offer the faster image recovery you're looking for. Also, I would think the odds of two hard drives failing in two different machines are lower than two hard drives failing in a single machine during the same event. Or put the image on a third hard drive, one local USB drive attached to the server, and two over the network drives to improve the odds, maybe via SyncBack as a post-backup event. That is such a great idea and so simplistic that since I got this email, that is already implemented. Thank you, thank you. And that is from Keith. This is from Mark. Hi, Mike, longtime listener to your show. Great show. Quick question. What cloning software do you use? Working on a client's laptop, changing from SSD to spinning drive. I use Acronis. I love the clone option in Acronis. I use that all the time. That is my favorite cloning software. There's lots of great ones out there. Lots of listeners have shared different cloning options. Going back through the shows, you should be able to find a significant amount of options to choose from. But I use Acronis. This is from Cormac, regular listener. Hello again. Hope all is good. I was wondering, what are you using to clone HDD, a hard drive, to SSD, and what way do you do it? As in, what steps? Would you run a check disk first on the hard drive? Also, that was a good question. I'm going to continue here. Also, are you cloning from bigger drives to smaller SSDs? Any advice would be great. Things are going very well here in Ireland, and I am all in on Malwarebytes TechBench. Great, great tool set. And I like reselling Malwarebytes as I can stand over it. Thanks for all your help, Cormac. Here's my suggestions. You have a great idea, but that check disk can take a long time. I only go back and run check disk if the clone fails. So the first thing I do is, how much data is on the drive in the use of the computer? Now, I'm cloning a lot of terabyte drives down to 240 gig SSDs because they're not using a terabyte. If they're using under 100 gig or even up to, my cutoff is like 120 gig. If they have 120 gig of files and data and programs on a hard drive, I will clone them to 240. Anything bigger, I recommend a 500 gig. My son just finished a clone on a client this past Monday where the client has 600 gig and he cloned to a terabyte SSD. So look not at the actual size of the source drive. Look at how much data is being consumed on the drive and then size the target solid state drive appropriately. Once we do that, we have a cloning bag. We have Acronis bootable on a USB stick, Acronis bootable on a CD. We have data cables that are USB 2 and USB 3. We have SATA cables in case it's a desktop and we can take advantage of quickly just connecting a SATA and power connector to a solid state drive. We leave the original drive in place. We clone externally to the new solid state drive, following the Acronis clone drive procedure. The first thing you have to do when you attach a new drive and you boot from the USB stick is you got to add the new drive because it's got to initialize it. We add that drive, and this is where you got to be very careful. You got to know the make and model of the drives you're working on and use common sense in what's listed there. You don't want to be initializing or doing anything to the original data drive. So now we add the drive. Then we perform the clone. The clone, if everything's perfect, if you have a great USB 3 connection, or if you're connected via SATA and everything's perfect, that can be 8 or 9 minutes. Typically, it's a half hour. If you have a lot of data, this could be over an hour. Acronis will report back if there's an error. And if we see an error or a problem, then we got to take a look, run a check disk. I've had to do that. Not often, but I've had to go back and run a check disk. And this is where the time, it will eat at your time. When I run into that, I often want to reschedule the clone and suggest we begin a check disk that evening. Maybe I remote in and kick it off, let it reboot, let it do the check disk, and let's see what happens. So based on the error that you get, research the error accordingly. Have I ever not been able to clone a disk? And my answer is no. And now that I say that, I'll run into 10 of them next week. No, I've always been able to clone a disk. Check disk has been my only problem where I've had to run that, and it has fixed the problem and then let me successfully clone it. The big tip that I've discussed in the past, QuickBooks. If you have QuickBooks running, when you boot up, you will get an error on the clone drive, and you have to go in, and there's a licensing file, and you can Google this easily, that you got to rename or delete. Once you reboot, it'll recreate it. Everything's good, and the cloned QuickBooks will work. Backing up, once we do a successful clone, we then open the machine, put the new drive in. If it's a desktop, you're going to have a 2.5-inch to 3.5-inch tray. The Saberint tray is the one I use all the time. You may need power extensions for SATA. This is where sometimes if you have a small footprint hardware, the power connector may not all reach to the newly placed solid state drive, and you have to have a little pigtail extension. We have these. We have long and short SATA cables. I literally have a cloning bag that has all the tools needed for any hardware that's run into. It's got a little flashlight. It's got everything. What my team will do, whoever needs a clone, they're going to be cloning something, they grab the cloning bag, and it's got everything you need. It's got a 240 gig, it's got a 500 gig, and it's got a terabyte brand new SSD. It has all adapters, extensions, software, everything you need. It's a nice, tight little bag, and we clone all the time. So this is something that we regularly do, and if you prepare properly, you should be able to add this as a service. Final email is a listener who works for StorageCraft, and his name's Roy, and I know he's been a longtime listener, and he says, love the show. As a former MSP business owner, it scratches my SMB IT services itch. If you would like to kick your Shadow Protect StorageCraft skills to the next level, let me know. Roy, I absolutely do. He continues, I can do a 30 to 45 minute webinar covering how to easily replicate your image backups off-site for free, how to set up clients for DRASS, Disaster Recovery as a Service, in our cloud, boot and run an entire customer in our cloud, centrally manage all your endpoints, again for free. Anyway, keep doing what you're doing. Let me know if you would like more info on the latest from StorageCraft. Roy, thank you so much. As a matter of fact, I'm thinking this might be so good, this could be a dedicated show as a specialty show. And I set it up where maybe Roy's doing this and I'm recording it with a screencasting and somehow doing my webcam max to be broadcasting it live. That would be kind of cool. So let me see if I can make something happen with this, because that's some great information. It's stuff that we need to do, which is what I'm really interested in, is disaster recovery as a service in the cloud. That will resonate with clients of mine. He's right. I do need to kick up my StorageCraft skills. I need to give them a kick. And Roy, thank you for offering that. We have some very talented listeners out there. I want to take advantage of if they want to share the information for everybody. Remember to please support my sponsors, Instant House Call and Malware Bytes Tech Bench. Links are in the show notes. And I will be back here next week, same time, same channel, everybody. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.